What this bill doesn't do is it doesn't ban any meetings. What it does do is it protects employees from being able to leave these mandatory meetings and go back to work and get their job done.
Those are exactly some of the books that kids need to be able to say, I see myself in this. I'm reading this and I feel like I'm reading about myself.
One of the workers, a man actually, asked the governor, can you tell me how can I live with this salary? My salary is very, very small. And the government said something very stupid. He said, when I was young, I took much less. This makes the workers angry.
The owners of that flat capital are not simply capable of extracting surplus value from wage labor, but they can create platforms like Amazon, like Alibaba, like Uber, like Airbnb. I call them cloud thieves. They are made of cloud capital.
First, you build your power. First, you build your base. That's where the resources need to go when you have a shrinking or stagnant labor movement.
You're listening to the Labor Radio Podcast, weekly produced by the Labor Radio Podcast Network, laborradionetwork.org. I'm Chris Garlock. On today's show, union organizing and Colorado House Bill 1230, books for our community, an interview with Egyptian trade union activist Ahmed Badawi. Capitalism is dead. Welcome to techno-feudalism. And former Vermont AFL-CIO President David Van Dusen talks about his new book. This week's featured shows are Labor Exchange, Colorado's only labor-focused radio show on KGNU Community Radio, El Cafecito del Día, the podcast from the Labor Council for Latin American Advancement, Labor Start, the official podcast of Labor Start, the news and campaigning website of the international trade union movement, the Green and Red podcast, where organizers, academics, and artists discuss radical environmental and anti-capitalist politics, and We Rise Fighting, labor theory, news, history, and analysis. That's all ahead on this week's edition of the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly. And hey, don't forget, Labor Radio Podcast Network t-shirts are now available. Check them out on our website, laborradionetwork.org. The Labor Radio Podcast Network crew is heading to Labor Notes in Chicago. If you're there, do look out for us. We'll be leading workshops and we'll have an interview station set up in the main vendor room. Just look for us in our new Labor Radio Podcast Network shirts. And keep an ear out for special daily reports from Labor Notes as we bring you the voices of today's labor movement. Here's the show.
Boulder, 1390 AM Denver, and 98.7 FM Fort Collins. Find us online on KGNU's website or your favorite podcast app by searching for KGNU Labor Exchange. I'm your host, Robert Lindgren, with the Colorado AFL-CIO and Denver Newspaper Guild, Local 37074. Our guest today is Alejo Gonzalez, political coordinator and organizer with the Service Employees International Union, Local 105. We're talking today about a new bill that they're working on. So we're talking about House Bill 1260, the Worker Freedom Act. The official title is Prohibition Against Employee Discipline. We've got bill sponsors with that. Majority Leader Monica Duran, Tim Hernandez, I believe the youngest serving legislator right now, and then Jesse Danielson in the Senate. Can you explain the bill, what it does, why it's necessary, or what the background is around it?
Yeah, Tim Hernandez, youngest legislator and union member. So the bill is really exciting. It's been passed in six other states with similar language. We'd be number seven. I believe Illinois also just introduced one as well. So what this bill is really aiming to do, and what I really, coming from the organizing side of things, I know it's just a huge uphill battle for workers to be able to just get a voice at their workplace by having a union. So one of the common things we saw in union campaigns and just really in, even in our internal work and other campaigns in general, is these mandatory meetings. So, you know, you want to organize a union, you hear there's a mandatory meeting all day, you work at a nursing home, you get pulled from the floor with your residents, and you got to sit in a mandatory meeting about why the union is bad, right? You should be working, you should be with the residents, you should be doing your job, but the reality is that these are mandatory meetings where you have to talk about why the union is bad, what you're, you know, quote unquote, know both sides or get all the information, but it's really just getting filtered through a quote unquote lawyer who's the company's spending thousands of dollars on to what's called union bust, right? Break up the union. It's just really a lot of different reasons why these mandatory meetings are problematic. Now, what this bill does is it just allows employees to just not want to participate in that and have protection from retaliation. So any employer can still run a meeting. They can still talk about how much they hate unions or how much they love Trump or Biden or whatever. But this bill protects those employees who do not want to participate in those meetings. What this bill doesn't do is it doesn't allow workers to also get out of the meetings if it's important to their job duties or related to their job duties, right? So like sexual harassment and DEI, like those are things that are part of your job duties. You can't have an environment where you're sexually harassing each other, and you can't have an environment where you're discriminating against one another. So what this bill doesn't do is it doesn't ban any meetings. It also doesn't ban employees who have personal opinions from getting away from their job duties. What it does do is it protects employees from being able to leave these mandatory meetings and go back to work and get their job done.
All right. And why do you think employers use these type of mandatory meetings?
It's really hard to get in front of people when you're trying to form a union. And so when the boss can just flex, hey, you need to be here at this time all day, take you away from work, close down the business a lot of times, or impose, you know, religious beliefs on you that you may not have or you may disagree with, it makes an uncomfortable work environment. They thrive on people not trusting each other, on people questioning everything, being confused, overloading them with information, which some of it's accurate, some of it's not. And that's when they win fighting back unions and fighting back workers having a voice, is when people just get so confused. They're just like, you know what? I don't even care anymore. So it's an extremely effective tactic. And I really hope, you know, I've heard horror stories on some of these things. Like, we had really good testimony in committee around what these meetings were like. So I really hope we are able to secure protections for workers, because it's really just a bad tactic.
This has been the Labor Exchange on KGNU Denver and Fort Collins. Find us online at KGNU's website or your favorite podcast app. I've been your host, Robert Lindgren, with the Colorado AFL-CIO. Our guest today has been Haleo Gonzalez with SEIU Local 105. This has been the Labor Exchange.
Bienvenidos al cafecito del día. Our space to share stories and amplify the voice of our community within the broader context of the labor movement.
Bienvenidos. Soy Carmen Rodriguez. Today, we will be sharing this cafecito with the president of the Fairfax County Federation of Teachers. We will be talking about the importance of book distribution and how book banning can have an impact in our communities.
My name is David Walrod. I'm the president of the Fairfax County Federation of Teachers, and I'm also a special education teacher at Lake Braddock Secondary School.
Thank you for talking with us. Could you share with us a little about the Fairfax County Federation of Teachers, the communities you serve, and a little about the composition of the students who attend in this area?
So the Fairfax County Federation of Teachers, we represent all operational and instructional staff for Fairfax County. Basically, we represent any employee that isn't an administrator. And we are affiliated with the national union, the American Federation of Teachers. Fairfax County is a very diverse county. The county as a whole is one of the richest counties in the United States, but what you see is there's a very wide disparity between parts of the county and other parts of the county. So we have some places where, you know, that every house is worth $1 million, and then other places where every single school is a Title I school. So we have a very wide diversity in terms of the community that we serve. This event is actually being held in Wharton, which is off of Route 1. It's pretty close to Fort Belvoir. And a lot of the students that we serve here are either military families or militaries or families from a, you know, less economically advanced community. So a lot of the students here go to school that qualify for Title I.
What types of books will be available for distribution in this event, and what impact will it have for parents and teachers and students, of course?
So in terms of the books that we have a wide variety. We have about 40,000 books that are going to be available. And the books are going to be fairly evenly distributed between books for preschoolers, books for elementary students, books for middle schoolers, and books for high schoolers. So no matter where your student is, there are going to be books that they would be able to take advantage of. And I would say the biggest factor is we know reading is one of the biggest predictors of how students are going to do. Like if students are reading by third grade, we know that they are more likely to graduate high school. They're more likely to go to college. Reading is such a big predictor of future success. And so by getting more books into students' hands, we want to both develop a love of reading and help students become better readers.
What do you believe will be the impact on the community?
You know, I think anytime that you get books into kids' hands, you've made a difference. We want students to walk away being excited about reading. We want students to walk away really looking forward to kind of getting into their new books. And we hope that they become better readers as a result of this event. From a teacher's perspective, our teachers that come out are able to get up to 50 books for their classrooms. And again, we know that one of the biggest predictors of how students do as readers is, do they enjoy reading? Do they have a love of reading? And by having a diverse selection of books in their classroom library, they're going to be more likely to cultivate kids that want to read.
So we have seen over the last couple of years, this movement towards banning books. And we know the AFT has been vocal about this. What can you share with us about your views on book banning as educator?
I will say that if you look from a historical perspective, the book banners have never been the good guys. Like if you look anytime through history, I believe that parents have every right to say, I don't want my child to read this book. Parents absolutely can and should say that. I have a sixth grader, and there are definitely times where I would tell my sixth grader, I don't think you're ready for that book. But what I wouldn't do is I wouldn't go to my child's teacher and say, I don't want you to have anybody read this book. I might go to my sixth grader's teacher and say, I don't want my daughter to read this book. But there's a difference between me saying, I don't want my daughter reading this book and I don't want anybody reading this book. I think that a lot of the books that are being banned are books that would be very helpful for some students. And I think that parents should be able to make that decision for their own student. So again, if a parent wants to say, I don't think that my child should read this, great. But I don't think that they should be able to say, I don't think anybody should read this. That's where the problem is.
Do you think that the banning book has a middle or long-term impact on any students?
I definitely think that it has a long-term impact because if you look at the books that are primarily being targeted, they're books written by African-American authors. They're books written by LGBTQ plus authors. They are books with diverse characters. They're books with LGBTQ characters. And I think that those are exactly the sorts of books that some of our kids need to have in their hands. Those are exactly some of the books that kids need to be able to say, I see myself in this. I'm reading this and I feel like I'm reading about myself. And I think that's a valuable experience for kids.
Gracias por acompañarnos. Nos escuchamos en el próximo Cafecito del Día.
El Cafecito del Día is part of the Labor Radio Podcast Network.
Hello, this is Eric Lee from Labor Start, and I'm very happy to be having this week as our guest, Ahmed Badawi from Egypt. He's an activist, and he's going to talk to us about the struggle at the Mahala textile factory. Ahmed, welcome to the show.
I am happy to be with you, Mr. Eric.
Thank you. So can you tell us what exactly happened at this textile factory? And it's a government-owned factory, isn't it?
Exactly. In Egypt, the government make a lot of companies like a public entity, not directly run by the government, but they are related to the government. So this sector is called the public company sector. Okay, قطاع الأعمال العام in Arabic. قطاع الأعمال العام. So this sector is يعني when the president السيسي make raise or the minimum wages to 6,000 Egyptian pounds. This was only for the public sector, for the government employees and government workers. They were raised their minimum wages were raised to 6,000 EGP per month. But this decision didn't apply to the workers in the public companies sector. And this is a lot of workers, a lot of big companies, the big companies that the government used to own in the past, but now they are selling them one by one or little by bit, bit by bit. And so this decision didn't apply to them. So
let me just stop you and ask you, the 6,000 Egyptian pounds,
mm-hmm.
to make clear to our listeners, is something like $100, right?
120, exactly.
Yeah. For a month, that's a monthly salary.
Monthly salary, yes. Exactly.
That's extraordinary.
So one of the workers, a man actually, asked the governor, can you tell me how can I live with this salary? My salary is very, very small. And the government said something very stupid. He said, when I was young, I took much less, something like this. But actually, he didn't account the inflation, of course. So it was this make the workers angry. They shouted against him, and then he left. He left the factory, and the security closed the factory around the women. They were trapped inside the factory, and this was on Thursday. Then they left. Friday is our holiday, so the weekend. So they went home, and when they come back on Saturday, they started the strike. Yani, this happened in 22 of March. On 24th, they come back and announce they will strike and they will not work until they get the minimum wage raised, like the president's decision.
That they also wanted, they wanted more than just the minimum wage, right?
Exactly. They have a lot of demands.
And eventually, even though this was initiated, begun by the women, eventually the men joined in, right?
Of course, all of the factories joined. Except the factories that were the sections that were working on the exporting some goods, and they had some deals working on it, so they didn't stop to prevent the company to get sanctions or any problems with the money.
But in the end, how many workers actually went on strike? More or less.
Yeah, and I don't have the exact number, but it's maybe 10,000 or something like this.
Oh, well, this is a very large strike.
Yes, yes.
Uh-huh. Very large strike. Okay, so eventually the government gave in to the demand for the 6,000 pound monthly salary, right? But they didn't agree to anything else. Is that what happened?
Yes.
Yes.
They refused to negotiate with the workers. Yani, they summoned some of the workers to attend a meeting with the with the management and some people presenting the president and the minister and something like this, but they refused to accept any demands from them, and they threatened them to go, you are going to be jailed or something like this, and they threatened a lot of workers not to join the strike.
Right.
And after that, a lot of people, a lot of workers were summoned to the state security office. They were threatened and let them free. And after 1 week, the minister of the public companies announced that he will raise the minimum wage for workers to $6,000, of course, including the tax. And this number including taxes and a lot of other cuts.
Well, Ahmed, it's been fascinating talking to you. Thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you, Mr. Thank you so much.
Welcome to the Silky Smooth Sounds of the Green and Red podcast. I'm your co-host, Scott Parkin, at Berkeley, California. And as always, I am joined by
Bob Azenko in Houston.
And today we're very excited to be talking with Yanis Varoufakis, who is an economist, a political leader, the author of numerous best-selling books. He's the former finance minister of Greece. And he has a new book out, which we're going to be talking about today, which is called Techno-Feudalism, What Killed, we both have it, What Killed Capitalism. Welcome to the Green and Red podcast, Yanis.
Thank you so much for having me, Scott, Bob. It's a pleasure to be in your company.
Thanks.
Just to kick off with the book is that you have a very provocative thesis about tech feudalism killing capitalism. And so maybe we can just start off with the question is, why is capitalism dead? What has led to this monumental transition?
A new form of capital has risen up, has evolved. In the same way that some viruses produce variants, this is the language that we have been headed now from the pandemic, but just like viruses can produce variants that are extremely potent and toxic, so much so that stupidly they kill off the host that they rely on in order to survive themselves. This is my hypothesis. My hypothesis is that capital has been so triumphant. It has steamrolled over all opposition, from organized labor, from social democratic or democratic governments, the Green Movement, capital, wherever we look, we see its triumph. But this triumph, combined with the great financial collapse of 2008, which spearheaded the printing of rivers of money by our central banks, my estimation is around $35 trillion has been printed between April 2009 and last year, only in the G7. This amount of money, which was combined with harsh austerity for the masses out there, the United States, in Europe, in Britain, in my country, of course, we were the champions of austerity. This combination of austerity for the many brings down demand for goods and services, and huge liquidity for financiers meant that capitalists didn't invest, except those who invested in this new toxic form of capital, which I call cloud capital. Now, if my hypothesis is right, and this is my hypothesis, that cloud capital is a very novel form of capital. It's nothing like the capital we were used to. Capital so far has been a produced means of production, like a fishing rod or a tractor or an industrial robot, something you build to produce something else, a produced means of production. What lives in here, in our cell towers, on optic fiber cables, in server farms, and so on, this algorithmic capital, I call it cloud capital, because supposedly it's in the cloud. Of course, it's not in the cloud, it's right down on Earth, except some satellites. This cloud capital is a produced means of modifying our behavior, of behavioral modification. And the owners of that cloud capital are not simply capable of extracting surplus value from wage labor, but they can create platforms like Amazon, like Alibaba, like Uber, like Airbnb. I call them cloud thieves. They are made of cloud capital. They live inside the internet and digital technology, but they are like thieves in the sense that inside of them, they manage to magnetize users, you and me, but also vassal capitalists who produce stuff, like anyone who produces an app that they sell through the App Store, or anyone who produces an electric bicycle that they sell through Amazon.com. 30, 40% of the price goes to the owner of this cloud fiefdom. Ah, that's no longer capitalism. And here's my conclusion to this very long initial answer. My hypothesis is that cloud capital has replaced markets with cloud thieves, and therefore, in the process, it has shrunk severely the role of profits in this realm of ours, and it has expanded the role of rents, which are cloud rents. They are not ground rents, in the sense that you don't pay for the landlord anymore, as it used to happen under feudalism, but you pay cloud rent to Bezos and Zuckerberg and Apple and Google and so on for access to the cloud thief that has replaced markets. And that to me is not capitalism.
If you like what you're hearing, check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, which feels much more relevant after that interview. And if you want some green and red swag, we have hats. We have these fancy trucker hats, which Bob is now modeling for us, only for $25. Just email us at greenredpodcast@gmail.com, and we'll set it up so you make us a donation. Shipping and handling is included in the $25. You all should misbehave and make trouble. And Yana said organize, which is actually something we say a lot on the show too. So anyway, we'll catch y'all later.
All right, welcome back to another edition of We Rise Fighting Labor Podcast. We bring you today's labor news, history, and analysis from the U.S. and around the world. This is a podcast you listen to with your fellow workers organizing on the shop floor. This is a podcast you listen to before walking into your union meeting. As always, I'm Rick Urrutia, here with my co-host, Brian Pfeiffer. Tonight, we have a special edition of We Rise Fighting. We are once again interviewing David Van Dusen, now the former president of the Vermont AFL-CIO. This time around, we're going to be chatting about his new book titled Insurgent Labor, the Vermont AFL-CIO from 2017 to 2023. The book is available on pmpress.org. You know, one of the things that caught my attention was you had a section in your book talking about changing to win. And for me, change to win, that whole debate, that whole time period in labor history, I consider it now part of labor history, was very educational for me. There was a huge debate in the labor movement as to whether or not unions should create a new federation and call it Change to Win. I was wondering, you know, what you took away from that debate, what that time period meant for you, what lessons you got from Change to Win, that whole little time period that took place.
Sure. Well, look, first I'd say that in Vermont, we're very fortunate that part of our state labor council through something called Solidarity Charters are all of the SEIU locals, organizations here in Vermont are affiliated with us, and they have backed us at our conventions, backed us meaning united in our elections. And SEIU continues to do very good organizing. We have our Starbucks workers, our Ben & Jerry's workers in the retail shop, the doctors at UVM Medical Center, custodians in Bennington College, and a number of other folks organized with SEIU, many of them newly organized. And that's great. And we love to have their solidarity. SEIU, going back to when the split happened, AFL-CIO, they believed, rightly so, that we need to put more focus on organizing. One of the things that I think they did not go far enough is they did not have any significant difference, in my view, with the AFL-CIO when it came to still doing tons and tons of work and priorities on elections and on lobbying. Now, my mind, those things, legislation and elections come after. First, you build your power. First, you build your base. That's where the resources need to go when you have a shrinking or stagnant labor movement. And then later down the road, we could turn towards those questions again. SEIU and the unions that went with Change to Win, I frankly don't think it was as radical of a break as one may, somebody else may argue. I also have been loyal to the AFL-CIO, meaning this, throughout my working career and my career as a union person, the fact is the AFL-CIO is by far the largest labor organization in the United States of America. Change to Win essentially disintegrated. But even at their height, they were still a very small group compared to what remained in the AFL-CIO. Right now, we have about 12.5 million members in the AFL-CIO. We need to double that. We need to triple that. We need to quadruple that. But we're not going to see major change in society until and unless we galvanize the AFL-CIO to make it better than it is now. And I think that as a loyal AFL-CIO member, or more importantly, as a working class person that has a direct stake, a direct desire for radical change in society, democratic change, we need to make the AFL-CIO that vehicle for change. And if we believe that we're democratic, then that should be okay, right? We should be able to have open debate within the labor movement. We should be able to disagree with each other at times. But the first fight, that's one of the first fights, is I do think we have to change the national AFL-CIO to have officers directly elected by members. Right now, it's done by delegates. So 500 delegates at a national convention will decide who the national leadership is in an organization of 12.5 million people. If it was a country of 12.5 million people and you told me our process, we elect our president by 500 officials deciding who the president is, I wouldn't say that's a democracy. Now, we inherit those archaic Byzantine bylaws from times long ago, but now we're not in those long ago times. And I think we have to walk the talk and we have to change our bylaws. We have to change our constitution and we have to fight in a large coalition of progressive forces to make those changes, to make us more democratic, not just at the Vermont AFL-CIO level, but also at the national AFL-CIO level.
Thank you, David, for being on the show again. Thank you, listeners, always for listening to the show. We hope you got a handful of lessons out of speaking with David today. We will talk to you again next week. We'll be back to the regular news and reports on Palestine. Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.
All in there, brother. Thank you.
Great talking to you, David. Bye-bye.
All right, folks, that is going to do it for this week's edition of the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly. As usual, it's just a small sample of the amazing programs aired over the last week or so on more than 200 labor radio and podcast shows, all part of the Labor Radio Podcast Network. These are shows that focus on working people's issues and concerns. We've got links to all the network shows, all 200 of them, at laborradionetwork.org. You can also find them by using the hashtag Labor Radio Pod on X, Facebook, and Instagram. This podcast recorded under a SAG-AFTRA collective bargaining agreement. The Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, edited this week by Patrick Dixon. I produce the show, and our social media guru, as always, is Mr. Harold Phillips. The Labor Radio Podcast Network crew is heading to Labor Notes in Chicago. If you're there, do look out for us. We'll be leading workshops and we'll have an interview station set up in the main vendor room. Just look for us in our new Labor Radio Podcast Network shirts. And keep an ear out for special daily reports from Labor Notes as we bring you the voices of today's labor movement. For the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, this has been Chris Garlock urging you to stay active and, of course, stay tuned to your local labor radio podcast show.